Sure, I like kids, but I'm not here to start an orphanage. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Forklift, the only podcast in the world dedicated to films where forklift trucks explode. Now, let's be honest, in recent years it's been a terrible time to be an exploding forklift truck fan. Filmmakers just don't seem to be interested anymore in blowing up our favourite pallet-moving tool. This situation is made worse by the enthusiasm of directors to fill their films with the detonation of far inferior vehicles. And if we have to watch another film with an exploding helicopter, I may just stop watching movies altogether. In these dark times, it's natural for exploding forklift fans to look for comfort in a sadly now bygone age when no action film was complete without the spectacular combustion of a powered industrial loader. So, on this show, we're heading back to the 1980s and one of the classics of the exploding forklift genre, 1987's Codename Vengeance. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who never corners sharply with a raised load. It's the OSHA 30 certified Nick Rehack from Forklift Sunday. How you doing, Nick?
Well, I'm doing fantastic, and I'm more than excited to be joining you today.
Well, I am just as excited, I think, to have you with us because you are, a leading forklift truck expert. You've worked extensively with those vehicles throughout your career, and you're also obviously a massive exploding forklift truck film fan as well. So, for people who haven't come across you previously with your work, connected to forklifts, could you sort of lay out some of your credentials? You know, perhaps tell us about what your favorite forklift is.
Oh, absolutely, man. I've been driving forklifts on and off for 10 years. I say on and off because in 2012, I took a small break from forklifting to pursue broadcasting school. Didn't do it for me. Not enough loads to lift and carry around. So I kind of took a step back, went back into forklifting and warehousing. If I had to pick a favorite forklift, I know this is going to be very particular and I might catch some guff for it. But I'm a real big fan of the 2013 Hyster H60. A lot of people prefer the later models, the 2015 and the 2016. But for me, there's something about the 2013 that just it works for me. You know what I mean? It's not going to add all the extra gingerbread features of, cup holders and turn signals. And the, propane connection can be a little troublesome, sure. But That's my go-to guy. You know what I mean? You have people, they like their Yales, they like their Caterpillars or their Clarks. But for me, it's always Hyster. I've dealt with some diesels before. I had an old 2014, 2015 Toyota. Not a fan. I'm not real big into the diesel trucks. I'm not doing a lot of outside work, so diesel is a bit of an overkill. So just a nice liquid propane knocking it out of the park with that Hyster, that's my girl. That's my girl is the Hyster.
Well, that is the type of expertise I'm looking forward to you bringing to this exciting episode of Exploding Forklift. So let's not hang about. Let's get stuck into Codename Vengeance. So let's listen to a few unconnected snippets of dialogue.
There's only one specialist who can pull this off. Monroe Beeler. The only problem is, he's doing life in a Catal prison.
You and me are gonna take on Eugene Tabrak?
Brock took 12 years of my life.
Forget the rockets, it's not worth it!
The geopolitical interests of America are threatened when an evil terrorist called Tabrak kidnaps the wife and son of the leader of a nameless African country. After Uncle Sam decides to step in and help their ally, they quickly realize that there is only one man who can help, Monroe Beeler. Beeler, a former top CIA agent, just happens to have beef with Tabrak, who years ago imprisoned him for a crime he didn't commit. After being busted out of an African hellhole prison, Beeler teams up with his old mentor and a couple of CIA stooges in order to rescue the kidnapped victims and serve up the obligatory side order of personal revenge. Codename Vengeance came out in 1987. In the lead role, we have video store legend Robert Ginty. He's supported by Playboy playmate turned erotic thriller legend Shannon Tweed and the B-movie stalwart Cameron Mitchell. The film is directed by choreographer-turned-schlock-movie-impresario David Winters, who directed the skateboarding exploitation movie Thrashin' before producing and founding Action International Pictures, which made over 100 pictures during the 80s and 90s. This film has a 4.2 rating on IMDb and, worryingly, a 0% user rating on Rotten Tomatoes. So with all of that out of the way, Nick, what did you make of Codename : Vengeance?
It's tough because It was very difficult to procure this movie, and it was actually kind of a fun journey. I had to go on eBay. I found a VHS copy, and then I had to find a VCR, which apparently must be some like hip, cool thing, because a lot of them around here are like $60 and $70.
Ooh.
I went to a Goodwill and found one for $8, so I really lucked out. So watching this, I had the added advantage of like really experiencing what it was like to watch it like back when the film first came out in 87. But watching it, even with all that nostalgia around it, it's not good. It's a long road just to say that it's not good. There are some elements that I try to find the best I can in every film, right? There are some elements that are interesting, and it brings some like technical aspects that I never thought of before, camera shots or angles, things like that. But overall, it's just, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It doesn't, the things the characters say don't add up. How did you feel about it?
I think I feel quite similarly to you, because I mean this film it doesn't really make sense at all, and I think it's possibly because a lot of chunks of this film may have been cut out in order to just, you know, get it down to a tight 85, 90 minutes and just keep the pace up, keep the action scenes, you know, really flowing from one scene to another. Because there are just moments throughout the film where it just feels like entire scenes have just been cut out. And, you know, there's a whole character, like Shannon Tweed's character is introduced because she's meant to be keeping Beeler like on track with the mission that he's been set to do, and you kind of think, oh, there must be a moment where, you know, she tries to course correct Beeler, but she basically completely disappears out of the film and then just sort of comes back into it at the end as the pilot of this helicopter. And there are a couple of other instances like that where I just think whole chunks of this movie were sort of lopped out. Some of the dynamics between the characters really don't make sense, because like the main villain in the film, for instance, I've got no idea like what he's doing or why he's doing it.
To me, the character of Applegate, he felt very much like a parody or even a satire of like Bush Senior from that time. Bush Senior was running the CIA when Reagan was around, and that was a bit before this film came out. And to do something like some shady dealings like that, it makes sense, right? But obviously you make this character kind of very over the top and even like a bit of a fool sometimes. But what throws me is we have this instance where, you know, we're trying to save the wife and daughter of this African president. And he says, there's only one man for the job, right? There's only one guy that can handle this. And he's in prison, right? He's in prison. When we meet him in prison, he's getting the beat out of him. He barely escapes from this prison. And barely gets onto this truck that's taken him away. He seems to be kind of bumbling through everything. Yeah, he's a good shot. He's really good at not getting shot. But it just seems like, I don't know, it seems like Chuck Norris was busy. They found a guy, and he's just intensely not likable. It's not even like an anti-hero kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like, I can understand if it's like, oh, man, this guy was down on his luck. He caught a bad break. But here he is. He's turning around. Or, like I said, an anti-hero where it's like, man, he's not a good guy. But we're rooting for him. It's almost like no redeemable. And it almost seems like Sam's keeping her distance because she doesn't want to put up with him. And the only reason she's doing what she's doing is, you know, a bit of a reveal later on, which I'm like, okay, it's pretty neat. Kind of saw this coming. But, you know, I'm glad to, you know, see them at least trying to add it up and give it, I don't, some semblance of a story. I just feel like they jumped from set piece to set piece, and they said, well, we kind of need a story. We can't just have egregious shootouts. There are so many shootouts. I feel like the director hated the set director. He's like, look, I need a really nice dining room, and then he just shoots it up. Like, it was so much.
Well, I loved that scene at the beginning, which you were alluding to, which is, yeah, when T'Braq kidnaps the wife and son, and yeah, he bursts into the palace and just basically shoots up this room. And I loved the kind of that particular action sequence, because it really reminded me of the type of shoot 'em up gunplay that you got in things like Hot Shots, where you just have, you know, characters pouring into a room and literally just sort of, you know, falling on top of each other in seemingly impossible numbers. And you know, here it is, you know, not played for laugh. Here it is, just like played straight. And I just really enjoyed the over the top brio that the director brings to that scene. I mean, we see anything that can be blown up with squibs gets blown up. I mean, we see pictures, chairs, dining room furniture, and a rather nice looking fruit platter gets completely blown away by machine gun fire.
They spent so much time focusing on this watermelon just getting ripped apart, and it is squib heavy. Like, there's a scene where I can't remember what happens. It's something about there was like an outside fight, and he was like, we need reinforcements. And they catch a bunch of guys, and they're trying to find out, like, hey, you know, where are your other soldiers? Where is your base camp? He's not saying anything. So he just point blank shoot this dude in the head, not like an execution style thing, but like straight on into his head, like blood everywhere. And it's so egregious, but it stands out the most because of just how bloody and intense it is. But all the other ones feel just kind of like bang, and then you fall down. It felt like little kids playing like cops and robbers. Like, if you shoot, bang, bang, and they're like, oh, and they, you know, they grab their arm or whatever, and then they fall down like kind of lazily.
Classic shimmying death that I'd love to put an exact year on when that died out in films. I mean, I think it definitely carried on into the early 90s. Quite when it died out, I don't know, but yeah, it's that it's, as you say, it's that sort of death that you do when you're sort of you know, mucking around with your mates as a kid.
Yeah, and then they completely shot up the set, so it's not like they can do a second take, I don't think. I don't think anybody's taking pictures for continuity. It was so much. And then towards the end, I was like, all right, we get it. Just, can we mix it up? Can we get a knife fight in here? Can we – I mean, we do get a little bit of knife throwing, but, you know, just a little something to mix it up.
What did you make of the lead actor here? I mean, it's a guy called Robert Ginty, as I mentioned in the introduction. And, you know, he had a bit of a career in 80s exploitation. And, you know, I don't know if you've come across him before. I mean, his sort of most famous film is this film, sort of vigilante type film that came out in 1980 called The Executioner. It's very has a very famous sort of box art cover design. And he seemed to parlay that one film into a sort of action career in the 80s. And I don't really understand how he got away with it, because he's not in shape. He doesn't look terribly tough. He's not a particularly good actor. I mean, he's not a good actor at all, really. And I just, yeah, I don't really know how, off of the back of that one famous film, he managed to sort of get away with then sort of, yeah, doing these type of low budget action films for the next decade.
Yeah, I don't understand the appeal. Maybe it's like this weird everyman kind of vibe. But again, it just, he reminds me so much of just an unlikable, like, Chuck Norris. I guess maybe like the facial hair, the way the hair is parted, or that style of the 80s. But I'm looking at, he doesn't even have anything clever to say. You know what I mean? I can understand if he's like charming or witty, coming with the one-liners. Like, there's a scene where he and another character are investigating this RV. I don't know why, of all things, it's an RV. But one of the characters feels uneasy, and he says, I feel something. And you know what? He just says offhandedly, that's just your balls twitching. It's like, what? Not even like razzing him, like, oh, come on, you know, stop it or grow a pair or goof. Just that's your balls twitching. I think at one point he says there comes a time to get off the merry-go-round. Like, I don't know what writer or screenplay or whatever Tony Palmer's thinking of here, but there's nothing catchy. There's nothing dragging me in for this guy, and I'm okay. Like, I'm totally fine never seeing another one of his movies. I feel bad because, you know, I'm sure he seems like a nice guy. I've never heard of him before. I probably won't go seeking him out for anything else. Unless this is a one-off where they were like, hey, just play a tough guy, and he's like, this is what a tough guy is like. I don't know. I didn't care for him. And it kind of made me check out of the film sometimes where I'm just like, yeah, I don't care. Let's on to the next thing. And I try not to be like that. What's tougher is in a bad movie, you can kind of pause and figure out where you are, right? I don't know how to do that with a VCR. There's no display telling me how much I have left. So I'm like really sitting there like, Jesus Christ.
You got no idea how much further you've got to slog on through this. No. So you can't pace yourself. I mean, if you check on the time, you think, okay, got 30 minutes left. Think, oh yeah, I'm on the home stretch. I can settle in and, you know, we're going to get through this. But, if you're not really digging a film and, you've got no idea how much more of it is coming down the pipe, it doesn't help your mood. And I don't think that helps your disposition towards the rest of the film.
Yeah, absolutely not. Like you said, if you could see like you're in the home stretch or you're right there, it's like, all right, here we go. You get excited because we've seen a lot of films, not just ones with exploding forklifts in it or forklifts in general, but you and I have seen enough film to kind of fill in the blanks, right? It's no longer such a mad lib of like what's going to happen. It's like, okay, we kind of know that it's following this trajectory. Most likely one of two things is going to happen. So we look for those beats to clue us in, right? But with this, it's just like, I don't know what to look for. I don't know when to look for. And they go to such bizarre locations that after a while, it doesn't make sense. And it's not like they tell you in most action films where there's like a little thing on the bottom of the screen, like, you know, now we're in Cambodia or now we're in Detroit or hey, we're wherever. We're just kind of like, I guess we're all in the same place. I don't even know where Applegate's office is. Assumedly, it's D.C., but we don't know. It's just a room, right? There's no windows in any of these places.
Well, one thing I did want to talk to you about, especially as we've ragged on this film a little bit, I know that there are a couple of bits of this movie that we both enjoyed. There are two scenes in a bar that happen in this film. There's one that happens sort of at the beginning of the film, which you really like, and then there's another bar scene that happens a bit later, later in the film, which I really like. So let's start with that first one. So Bela has busted out of this prison. I mean, it's one of the I don't know why he's been in this prison for 12 years, because he just basically climbs over the wall and jumps in the back of a truck. I don't know why he couldn't have done that a decade earlier, but anyway, he gets out of this prison and miraculously finds himself some sort of very nice Miami Vice style suit, and we then find him in this bar. So yeah, what did you like about this bar so much, Nick?
So the whole premise is he's finally out and the guy's like, you know, he's got to cut loose. Applegate's like, he's got to cut loose a little bit. And he's like, you know, he hasn't seen a woman in however long. So he goes to this bar and it's basically a strip club. He's sitting there, but then we meet Shannon Tweet's character, Sam. She just kind of shows up and is hanging out and then comes over to him as if it's like a regular bar, a restaurant you'd be at just talking. And what does she say? Do you want to dance? Do you want to dance? To which he replies, it's been a while. What? It's a yes or no question. You know what I mean? Not like again, that's that whole there's nothing charming or witty. He's just like very detached and despondent. And then they start slow dancing at a strip club. It is so, so incredible that all of this is happening. I'm like, this can't be. And also, it's this big strip club. It's just him in this place of the dancer. There's not several dancers. There's not several people. You don't even see the DJ. In every other film, where there's a strip club, there's several dancers, there's a big stage, there's a DJ, there's a lot of people having fun. It's just him. It's as if Applegate bought the whole strip club out, had one dancer for him, and then slid this person in there.
The bit about that scene I particularly enjoyed was the chat after they're on the dance floor. They have this little chat. I think Robert Ginty says something like, "This is a dangerous country for a woman alone." And then Sharon Tweed's character says something like, "Ah, oh, well, you know, two people in a dangerous country shouldn't be alone." Like, it's the worst flirty dialogue I've probably ever heard.
I don't understand why they couldn't think of anything else clever. There's not even on set like, you know, maybe my character wouldn't say this. Maybe he would say this instead. Like, everybody's just like, you know, they're sticking right with it. And I'm like, come on, gang. Like, we got to be doing something else. We got to be doing better. This can't be it. The bar is low already. Let's try to do something with it, anything with it.
Now, the bar scene that I liked happens a bit later when Beeler has decided to take the job to bump off Tabrak. And he decides that in order to complete his mission, he needs to team up with his old mentor, who's played by Cameron Mitchell, whose character in the film has a great name. His character's called Dutch Musselmeyer. And he's this sort of very grizzled 70-something who's, you know, clearly just permanently sozzled all day. And Ginty finds him running this bar in the absolute middle of nowhere. So there's just this one hut in this empty expanse of the Serengeti, or wherever that we're meant to be. There's an American flag flying up above it, and we find Cameron Mitchell. Clearly he's the biggest customer in this bar that he runs, and he's chatting to some local who's in there, and it's, you know, he's telling him some old war story, and it's not entirely clear that any of the locals understand a single thing that that Cameron Mitchell is saying. And I just wondered, okay, you know, I want to film all about this bar. Like, why is it there? How is it there? Who goes to drink there? You know, how did this bar surface in the middle of this blasted location?
It's almost like an impossible window in Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, right? There's you don't see the power running to it. How does he have running water in a place like this? Everybody's just kind of nodding along. You don't really see a transaction of prices or of currency. Like, nothing's being paid for. He's just talking their ear off, and they're just kind of nodding and smiling, and it's improbable. But here he is doing his thing, just living his best life, I guess.
Okay, I think we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding forklift action.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding forklift action. This occurs fairly early in the film. After raiding one of Tabrak's weapons dump, our heroes find themselves involved in a car chase amidst an abandoned railway goods yard. The heroes lure their prey into an empty goods shed. They then rig a conveniently handy forklift truck with grenades and then send it trundling at a spectacularly low speed towards their enemy's vehicle. As the forklift hits the truck, Ginty throws a grenade which triggers the other explosives on the forklift to explode in a huge fireball. Nick, what did you make of the exploding forklift truck action?
Massive fireball, huge fire and explosion, and that had me very excited. I just wish it was a little more eventful to get there, because I feel like when it does explode, it doesn't have that awesome power you want it to. It feels like a lot of the other explosions we see in the movie, almost like an afterthought kind of thing. I was taking a good look. They didn't really have any identifying marks. To me, from my eyes, it looked like a Komatsu FD-45. I could be wrong, because again, no real identifying marks. It could have just been, you know, your basic gal or a caterpillar, maybe an old Selic. I'm not 100%, but looking at that Komatsu, it can get faster, sure, but it didn't scratch the itch all the way. It kind of scratched it and you thought it was done, but then it came back and you're like, oh, I got to get it, but you can't reach it now. That kind of itch. So much appreciation for the explosion itself, but getting there didn't ramp me up to get there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think one of the problems was, frankly, the speed with which this forklift moves towards the vehicle and moves towards the baddies, because it is going incredibly slowly. And, you know, I feel like this scene would have been definitely improved if that forklift had moved faster, because you're watching the scene, you're just wondering, why don't they get out of the way of this truck, which they can clearly see coming towards them? And it's, you know, it's moving so slowly that they've got ample opportunity to take some evasive action. But, you know, I mean, what kind of what's the sort of top speed you can hit in a forklift, Nick?
Well, it depends. On a model like this, the Komatsu, you're maybe going to crack 10 or 15, because you're not really hauling ass with a load in a diesel, right? Mostly you're outside. You need to be, you know, approaching safely, and you're handling much bigger loads. You know what I mean? You're looking at, I don't know, anywhere from an 8,000 to 12,000, you know, load that you can carry on that thing. You're not going to go fast. Now, if you have a little bit something smaller, like an electric one, you can get up there. I'm not saying I've taken a heister to 25 miles an hour, but I've heard of people taking a heister to 25 miles an hour. It's really intense, and it feels like you're going way faster than 25. You don't realize how fast 25 miles an hour is until you're on a propane forklift just gunning it in an empty warehouse on a Saturday. Nobody's around, so you have to make the fun and excitement for yourself. But at the same time, you're getting paid overtime, so it's not the worst thing. But yeah, they could have easily done something where this had gotten up speed. I mean, it is going down ramp, so it is giving it a little bit of a benefit of the doubt there. But they could have done something to really get in there. It's a lot like the what is it in Austin Powers, one of them, where they're coming down with like this big rolling machine, and the guy's literally yelling stop, and they're like, just get out of the way, and he's standing there yelling, and they just run him over.
I do think there were some other missed opportunities here, because when the forklift does explode, I would have liked to have seen, you know, one of those kind of like loading prongs cartwheeling off into the sky, and the, you know, the kind of heroes maybe having to, you know, duck out of the way as it comes flying past. And, you know, I feel like they could have just made a little bit more of the unique properties that an exploding forklift brings when it explodes.
Oh, my God, absolutely. You could have had, you know, one of the tanks somehow breaking through its carriage and busting out. You could have had a steering wheel flying up. You could have had a tire flying up, right? Even with car explosions, you get some debris, be it a door, right, that usually comes crashing down, the hood of a car, or as you would say, what is it?
The bonnet.
Not the boot, the bonnet of the car. There you go. I had one of the terms, right? But, yeah, absolutely. One of those forks could come flying off of there, no problem. It's not disappointing, but it leaves a lot to be desired.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Nick, thanks for joining me on this special episode of Exploding Forklift. Do you want to take a minute to plug film podcasts that don't focus on movies with forklift fireballs?
Yeah, absolutely. Recently, I was on an episode of Movies, Films, and Flicks. It's a podcast hosted by Mark Hoffmeyer. No forklifts involved, but we have an episode coming out. It's all about bathroom fight scenes. We break down about 10 different scenes. We had a lot of fun talking about it. Obviously, not as much fun if some had included forklift. Unfortunately, none of them are in an industrial place, or a place in which you would need a forklift, not even like a Walmart or a grocery store where it would have one of those little side forklifts, right, to just come off of very narrow shelving. But, yeah, that episode is out, so check out Movies, Films, and Flicks, obviously, after rewatching Codename Vengeance. Then go listen to that episode.
Thanks, Nick. As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Forklift website for more reviews of films where forklift trucks explode. We'll be back soon, but until then, keep watching the loading bays for those exploding forklifts.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.